Hello, Tim.
Hey, Chuck. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on today.
Yeah. Thanks for doing this. I really appreciate it. I've got, as you can see, I've got three of your books that I binge read over the weekend. So I'm trying to.
Oh, my God.
As much as I can, I tried to watch some of your Alien episodes, Ancient Aliens episodes, and I tried to listen to some of your interviews, but it looks like I still have not been able to figure out everything that you do. I was just reading your bio. I was like, wait, the pyramid stuff, you worked on that too? Like, there's so many things. I keep learning more about you. It's amazing how much you've done.
Yeah, I've been around the block a couple times. So.
Yeah. What is the stuff you did? Explain the, you explored the pyramids? You went there?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was my past job was I was in television production. And the station that I worked for used to do a basically it was a morning agriculture report, you know, amongst other things. And one time, a number of times, we got sent overseas with various either state or federal government organizations. And while I was in these various locations, I got into contact with people I knew in these countries who were also involved in, you know, investigating paranormal activity, UFOs, cryptids, things like that, and just, you know, got to meet with them and go to some locations when I had the time that they were working on. One of the locations was the Great Pyramids on the Giza Plateau. The person who took us there just happened to be a government official. So we got access to places, you know, on the Giza Plateau that, you know, weren't normally accessible to, you know, tourists and the like.
Was there anything that you saw there that surprised you that you wouldn't see on TV or read about in a book or anything?
Well, you know, I mean, there are all kinds of blocked up doorways and passageways and things like that that are written about, but really nobody has access to them. Some of them have been blocked up for 100 years or more. You know, we didn't personally weren't able to go up on top of it, but the Sphinx has an entranceway on the top of its head. If you go online and look, you'll see like drone footage and stuff that shows it, but it's not talked about. I guess that there have been some shows that were able to get inside of it, but only for, you know, a little ways. You know, it's either, you know, too dangerous or just off limits, period.
Yeah, it's interesting. My dad went and looked at the pyramids and he said one of the things that surprised him was he said, well, I never realized when I got inside, it's a very tight tunnel. And he's like, I realized I was claustrophobic. I was like, actually, I think that's probably a natural reaction from the way he described how small those tunnels are. I think anybody would be kind of freaked out.
The grand passage that takes you in there is huge.
Oh, really?
I mean, oh my gosh, you would not believe how big that is. And there's just, I don't think it was made for people to walk up. So they've put like wooden steps on the floor so you can climb up it, but it's pretty big. But, you know, like once you get into, say, like what's called the King's Chamber, you know, it's fairly good size, about the size of a room. But then if you go on into some of the, like, gosh, I can't remember what it was called, but there's another room on top of the King's Chamber that's small, you know, you have to duck kind of down to get into. And then if you go to the base of the pyramid, there is a really, really tiny, tiny room in a small passageway to get into that. Some say that that was like supposed to be the original burial ground of the king, but that after a while they decided to, you know, put it in the middle of the pyramid. You know, who knows?
Interesting. Is it cold inside of those? Because it's like, it's so down into the ground and everything covered by the sun, or is it stuffy? What is it, the temperature like in there?
I seem to remember that it was slightly cooler than the outside, but it seemed to me it was a little bit more humid.
Okay.
But no, it wasn't cold. Not cold at all.
What does it smell like? Cause it's so old. Is there a weird smell or anything?
No, it smelled like rocks and dust.
Okay.
Yeah. That's the thing that I remember. And I remember that, the producer who went with me on this trip, he kept looking around and was like, you know, this has been up for thousands of years. He goes, don't you think it's about time? You know, he kept thinking it was going to collapse on him at any time now. I think he was a little claustrophobic about it.
Yeah, that would be scary. So what is your theory with the pyramids? Because I think I remember when I was a kid just learning about it in school, it was just kind of like, okay, there was a civilization and they, you know, like we learned about how they buried the dead and all this, and that's what the pyramid was for. And now all this stuff is coming out, these theories about aliens and how these pyramids might have been used for some sort of electrical signals and things. I mean, do you think there's any credence in any of that?
Well, I don't think that it was built by aliens. And I know a lot of people are disappointed, you know, when I say that, because they think that I'm going to be like, oh yeah, flying saucers came down and levitated the blocks. No. I mean, I think that they were man-made structures. Now there's the possibility, because I have tossed around the theory that we're not the only superior civilization that has arisen on this planet. All right. There were probably others before us that, you know, that may have achieved a technology, you know, maybe comparable to ours and beyond. But, you know, I mean, the Earth has been here for, you know, a couple billion years. So, you know, a lot can happen and, you know, arise and disappear in shorter periods of time than that. So there could be a possibility that there was another civilization pre-Ice Age that for whatever reason suffered a catastrophe, maybe a natural catastrophe, and that there were survivors that were scattered all across the world that still had remnants of this knowledge. And you see this in a number of ancient writings that talk about how early people from this civilization were pretty barbaric, but then there were the gods, you know, quotation mark gods, that either came from the seas or from the mountains or things like that, who brought them knowledge, mathematics, art, agricultural things like that. So there could be a possibility that the ancient Egyptians were taught the mathematics in order to start their civilization and to be able to build the pyramids, but man-made, definitely.
How did they do that? And how did they carry those bricks and all? I mean, do you think there's tools that we haven't found yet? Or, I mean, I guess there's three possibilities. One is, you know, whatever the story that we learned in school, you know, they carried the bricks and yada, 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 or there was some other technology that either we haven't found or there's some technology that we found that is being covered up, right? Is that a possibility that this is being hidden from the general public?
Yeah, I don't think it's being hidden from the general public. I think that right now we just don't really know. I mean, the stones that make up the pyramid, I mean, they're big, but they're not huge. They're not like megalith, but they are heavy. So, I mean, you know, it would take some effort to move them into place. You know, some of the other megalithic structures that you see around the world, you know, that they do. It has me wondering how they were able to move them. And I can't remember the locations, maybe, you know, in Egypt. But there were like stone quarries where there were huge pieces of rock. I mean, you know, the size of buildings that were being quarried out that were, it was never completed. So, you know, the question, you know, the question is, how did they do it? But I think the real answer to that is, they did it because they could. You know, it, they didn't do it because it was hard. They did it because it was easy. And so, you know, we need to find out how it was easy. Yeah.
Right, we still don't, like, that's what I'm saying. Well, we don't have the answer, really, right?
No, no. Well, I mean, you know, so, now see, like, the stones of the pyramids could be, you know, fairly easily moved with modern day cranes or things like that. Some of these other stones, no. You know, they couldn't be moved, you know, using a modern equipment. And it would take a hell of a lot of people, you know, with ropes and dragging them around to try to get them to move. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I wish I had, you know, like a good answer. But then again, don't trust anybody who comes to you who says, oh, yeah, I've got the definitive answer to all these things. Because,
well, no, I think that's what's so fascinating about it is there isn't an answer. So I just like to explore the different possibilities.
Oh, yeah.
And see, I mean, that's what, you know, and I think in those Ancient Aliens episodes, the ones, I think one of them that you did was about some of these islands, and there was giants, stone giants that were like 8 feet tall. I think that was the island of Sardinia. That sound right? Oh, yeah. And then there was one that I think the one, maybe I can't remember which one that you talked
about. It wasn't Sardinia.
The Solomon Island. That was another one.
Yeah.
And maybe there was giants still living there because there was footprints of giants they didn't really explain in the episode how those got there. If it was a prank or something, it was interesting.
Now, there's one island and, gosh, and you have to remember, I did those episodes in 2013. Sure. So, you know, I've had some brain cells die since then. the one that I talked about, quite a bit, was it's an island where they actually have made like other islands out of these volcanic basalt columns that they quarried out of like another location and then somehow managed to transport them, you know, across the sea. Yeah, I mean, not a huge amount of ways. I mean, you know, not like hundreds of miles, but, you know, like within the same chain of islands. But still, I mean, you know, you're talking about something that took place like, you know, maybe I think they were saying like about 1,000 about the year 1,000 after Common Era. They built like an entire city and lagoons and roads with these basalt columns. And it's just amazing. And the people who still live there, they say that the people who built these were wizards, and that they were able to float these columns in the air to get to, right, you know, get to their location. And the columns do retain a magnetic field that isn't common with the rest of the area. They have a specific electromagnetic energy about them, you know, like a remnant. And some of the stories that had circulated when the first sailors then in like around the 16 and 1700s got to that area, supposedly this island had magical properties that would steer storms away from food islands that were close by, islands that were used to grow food for the populations. And they were susceptible then to cyclones and flooding. Well, supposedly this area had the magical abilities, you know, magical, to cause the storms to deviate, you know, away. So, you know, whatever that is, you know, if it's just myths and legends, But remember, myths and legends probably all have some kind of basis in reality at its originating point.
Well, yeah, and I think that's what's so interesting when you look around the world and then you start seeing similarities, because I think that was also in one of the episodes that you did. I don't know if it was one that you talked about, but how they have found some similar markings on the walls in the Grand Canyon that were similar to India, like these people with like elongated heads. I mean, mm-hmm. I guess it could be a coincidence, but it's just odd that they'd be drawing the similar type of being in two different, totally different parts of the world.
Oh, yeah. If you look at ancient writing, petroglyphs, paintings, statues all across the planet, you'll find some really amazing similarities that to me shows that at least within our history, and again, this probably goes to a pre-ice age, there was a worldwide civilization that had disappeared for whatever reason, some kind of cataclysm, volcanic activity, something maybe that started the ice age and flooded the planet, which then gives us a lot of these mythologies of a great flood, not a worldwide flood where everything was covered, but floods in various regions enough that you would have these legends crop up. But yeah, I mean, I think that there is a connection in our ancient past with all of these types of things, especially the similar writings, out of place writings, like ancient Mesopotamian writings that show up, like you said, in the Grand Canyon or in the Midwest of the United States or South America. But I think it just shows that people have been on this planet a lot longer, I think, than modern science is willing to admit, and that whatever this past civilization was, it probably had a fairly advanced technology that the legends say that it all disappeared in the blink of an eye. So whatever could have happened, I mean, there's all kinds of different scenarios, and of course, in Earth time, the blink of an eye would be, could be 1,000 years, which is pretty short, really. But for, people at the time, with the with the floodwaters coming in, inundating coastal regions, societies collapsing, I mean, that's a pretty major event that would then resonate with people all across the planet for generations to come. And we see in some of these spoken word mythologies just that type of scenario.
Yeah. Well, and that's one of the ones that you talk about in Antarctica book. Well, you talk about, I never really heard this theory, because you hear about, the aliens and things from outer space, but I never heard this, that there may be things that live under the Earth. And you said there was Chinese, Egyptian, Hindu, Eskimo, and even Irish, which I'm Irish and I didn't know. There's legends that in those cultures of a race that lives under the Earth's crust. That's mm-hmm. fascinating.
Oh, yeah. Well, if you look at most of world mythologies, when it comes to origin stories of the human race, we've either come from the stars, or our creators came from the stars, or we came from underground, or our creators came from underground. It's usually one or the other. And you look at the, like the Native American, I think it was the Hopi traditions of the ant people. The ant people were an underground race that brought us to the surface of the planet But in even more recent times, the ant people came back out from underground and took the ancestors of the Hopi back underground when there was going to be some kind of catastrophic event. And again, this may harken back to either the beginning or the end of the Ice Age, when just, you know, all kinds of bad things were going on. But I mean, that is part of the Native American legends, stories of the ant people and their underground world. And this was around the Grand Canyon area. And in fact, there are areas around there that are still considered sacred by the native population, because this was the area that the human race was taken underground and saved by whatever was going on the surface of the planet. But you go all across the planet and you'll find very similar stories of how the young human race came out from underground when we had lived in the big caverns, the giant spaces underground, and had no knowledge of the upper world. But then there was some, you know, like either a deity or a hero, a human hero, who led the population from the cavern worlds up into the surface to populate it. A lot of the stories that then came down to us, especially in like the 18th and 19th century, about the hollow earth, you know, that the planet is hollow inside, like a rubber ball with no center to it, and that the crust is only, say, about, you know, 1,000 miles thick, comes from these ancient stories, which never really referred to the planet like that. But to some of these, early scientists, you know, that's, you know, seemed somewhat plausible. We didn't have a lot of knowledge of what the interior of the planet was like. So the suggestion that the planet could be hollow, and some even suggested that there was a small sun, you know, in the center of this space that then kept the interior heated. You know, that went on into the 20th century. I have several books that were written by people in the 20th century that talked about this possibility, that there were openings in the North and South Poles that allowed a passageway, not only of water and atmosphere, but people, if they were brave enough to try to do it. There was a photograph, a satellite photograph that was taken sometime in the early 1960s. One of the first photographs of the Arctic that seemed to show some kind of giant opening. I think it may be even in that book that you have there, and it was published all over the fringe press. You know, saying here's proof. You know, the big polar opening into the inner Earth. More than likely, it was just an area that couldn't be photographed because of either, say, the reflection of the ice or the time of the day that the photographs were taken. Because you have to remember, these satellite photographs are taken in squares, small squares that are then melded together by NASA or whoever's doing the photographs in order to make a composite picture. You know, I mean, I'm at least that's to me, that's probably a more plausible explanation than there are actually polar openings.
But isn't there too, hasn't the government said they've blocked off certain parts of like Google Maps and Google Earth or whatever? They blurred stuff out because they said this is a security risk. So it's possible that they could be blurring something out or changing it from Antarctica, right?
Yeah, that's a possibility. This almost harkens to the stories that you see circulating now And I know I'm going to get some people honked off at me for saying this, but, you know, people who believe in the flat earth, that there is this big government conspiracy worldwide, I guess, to hide the fact that the earth is flat. And of course, my question is that, you know, most world governments haven't been around long enough to be able to maintain such a conspiracy. And some people say, well, it's NASA. NASA's, you know, trying to, you know, hide from us. Well, NASA only came about in the late 1950s. So who was maintaining this government conspiracy or this scientific, you know, conspiracy, you know, all these years? And I think it's kind of like that with some of these stories that have cropped up about maintaining secret areas from the public, you know, by, you know, put add in your bad guy here, you know, NASA, the government, Google, Twitter, you know, what have you. I'm fairly satisfied that there has been enough civilian expeditions over most of the planet to pretty much prove to me that, first of all, it's not flat, and that there aren't any polar openings either. Now, saying that, that's not to say that there aren't huge caverns underneath the surface of the planet. We know that that's a fact. South America is riddled with ancient caves and man-made tunnels that lead to, you know, huge caverns. Some of them volcanic, some of them have been augmented by people, and supposedly places like the Himalayas, Tibet, Nepal, you know, have very similar networks. Out west, like especially like in the Four Corners area, New Mexico, places like that, there are stories of similar types of tunnels, either natural or, you know, man-made augmented. So I mean, I think that is a very good possibility. And again, this harkens back to a lot of these ancient stories of these ancient civilizations who had built and maintained these places. You know, because to me, and we're doing it today, what better place to save yourself from some kind of catastrophe that's upcoming than to move underground? You're pretty safe. You don't have to go down that deep. And there are plenty of already established caves that you can move to and then build onto yourself. So, I don't doubt that these locations are real.
So you think, because I never heard of this term until the last few years, DUMs, they call it, deep underground military bases. Those are legit. I mean, but do we know how many are underground and where they are? Are these all secret?
I would say the majority of them are secret. But I mean, you know, we know that they've been built. I mean, what is it? The NORAD facility in Colorado is, this was built right into a mountain. That one's well known. I mean, that was supposedly built to safeguard our defense system from any kind of atomic attack. And in fact, it's so well built that even a direct hit from a tactical nuclear weapon probably wouldn't faze it. Now, I doubt it would be very comfortable, you know, living inside one of those places, you know, under such circumstances. They're pretty confident that people would survive. So, I mean, if they've built one, you know that they've built others.
Yeah. Do you think that one is connected to the Denver airport? That's where a lot of the conspiracies come from. I mean, you said Colorado. I'm just wondering.
Yeah. I'm not quite sure how far that is from the Denver airport. But you know, the stories go that especially in the Southwest, that there is a whole network of various kinds of tunnels that go from one facility to the other without ever having to get out onto the surface. And again, to me, it makes sense because if you're trying to build underground military facilities to safeguard either from attack or to work on, you know, whatever defense capabilities that you have, then you're going to have some efficient way to get around that's not going to involve coming out onto the surface and, you know, either taking in, you know, cars, trains, or planes to fellow facilities. Now, whether or not these underground tunnel systems are as vast and far-reaching as some people say they are, because I mean, you know, you've got some stories that these networks of tunnels using, say, like maglev trains and stuff reach as far as coast to coast.
Wow,
that's the United States is a huge country.
I feel like that would be hard to cover up. Like somebody would leak that, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, we, you know, people ask me that. He goes, well, if you know, if this kind of stuff was real, you would think that information would be leaked. And I said, well, it has been. We're talking about it. You know, it has been leaked, but it sounds, a lot of it sounds so crazy that it ends up in kind of like the stuff that I write about. And you know, that's one of the efforts that's been made over the years to try, I think, to keep this kind of stuff secret, is to allow bits and pieces of it to get leaked and then become part of this fringe element that not only do you have these underground facilities, but they're being manned also by extraterrestrials from Zeta Reticuli, who have signed a treaty with the United States government to kidnap people and bring them to these facilities to have all kinds of horrendous experiments done on them. So after a while, you get all this stuff glommed onto the original stories, and most people are just going to shake their heads and like, that's just more crazy crap.
Right. You know? Well, so which one though, this one is documented, the Nazis, was it a base in Antarctica? Am I thinking the North Pole or the South Pole? They had some Arctic base, right?
It was Antarctica. Yes.
It was Antarctica. Yes. Okay. Cause I think I saw a documentary on it. It was fascinating. I mean, the thing was empty now, but it was like, what were they doing down there? It was interesting.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, well, you know, the Germany had been interested in Antarctica for quite a while, even before the war, and like other countries, had set numerous expeditions there just to find out what was going on. But it was determined that a base be established in Antarctica. At first, the story was is that they were going to put up like a weather station, and you have to remember that at the time, Germany had access to shipping facilities out of South Africa. So I mean, it's a ways to go, but not that far from South Africa to Antarctica. And the stories go that as the Nazis came into power, it was decided that Antarctica, that this base in Antarctica would be one of the locations that they would establish and maintain amongst others across the planet that they could get access to. Antarctica, you know, was supposedly didn't belong to anybody. So really, at the time, anybody could build a base there and say, you know, this, you know, this is our base. Nobody can do anything about it. So the story goes that as the war progressed, and fairly early on, Germany realized that they weren't going to win. So they it was decided that a lot of the stuff that they were working on, that they stuff that they were working on, technology as well as valuables, money, art, gold, things like that, be shipped to this base in Antarctica in order to safeguard it and to help fund anything that was going to happen after the end of the war. Because the thinking was, well, we may lose this war, but we could win the next one.
They were going to restart the Fourth Reich, I think, right?
Yes, exactly, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, they also had communities in South America as well.
Argentina, yeah.
Right. Well, you know, Argentina, Patagonia, you know, all, you know, there were a number of very friendly South American countries. What was
the thing about the Holy Lands of Jesus, that they had that in Antarctica maybe? What is that? That sounds like an Indiana Jones movie or something.
It does, doesn't it? Well, you know, it's a fascinating story because there was an entire branch of the Nazi Party who were very interested in occult practices. All right, they saw themselves as really the rightful heirs of the planet, and that they were going to bring back these old German religious beliefs that predated Christianity and everything like that. And so they thought that if they collected all kinds of different holy objects, didn't matter what the religion was, the feeling was is that there were items that had power. Religious, spiritual, occult, whatever you'd want to call it. And that if you collected enough of them, then you would have enough occult power to help rule the world. It sounds kind of far-fetched, but I mean, you know, you had Nazis who were actually practicing these ancient spiritual rituals in order to have the gods bless them, so to speak, with their abilities in order to and it sounds almost Lovecraftian, that the idea was that after a while, you could use these occult practices to bring back the old gods to rule over the planet, and that the Nazis would be the human, what would the word be? Not priest isn't the right word, but you know, like the human contingent of these ancient gods. And again, one of the ways to do this was to try to gather up as many holy objects from across the planet as you could. So there were a number of archaeological expeditions, and that's what they were referred to, archaeological. But they were under the auspices of the SS that went all over the planet, especially places, say, like Tibet, and raided all across Europe as well, South America, Asia, in order to bring in what were considered holy objects. And the Lance of Jesus, or the Lance of Longinus, I can't remember the Roman name for this, but supposedly this was the sphere that was used to pierce Jesus' side when he was on the cross. All right. He wasn't dying fast enough, and this Roman guard felt sorry for him and actually jabbed him with this spear in his side. And according to the Bible, then blood and water came from the wound. Well, this spear then was considered then a holy object. and was kept at various secret locations by Christendom over the years, and was seized at some point by the Nazis. I can't remember originally where they found it, but they did. And it was held in Berlin for a number of years. Supposedly, it was supposed to be then taken to the secret base in Antarctica, but it didn't quite make it. The Allied forces descended on Berlin too quickly to get this one out, and it actually was found by an American soldier who held on to it for a while, thinking that he was going to try to take it back to the United States and sell it, you know, like a lot of American soldiers, you know, did with artwork that they discovered in the possession of the Nazis. Fortunately, though, it was found and then turned over to the authorities. And you know, now that you ask me this, it's supposedly on display somewhere in Europe, and I can't think of where that location is. It's, you know, if you Google it, you can find it. There is some debate, though, on whether or not it's the real one or not.
Of course, yeah. I'll put that on my bucket list to see, though. But back to Antarctica. So then, but the U.S. went down there to explore, too, the Operation High Jump and the Admiral Byrd. And I heard that story that was in your book before about when they flew over, they lost radio contact, and then they saw, like, green grass and, like, a city and all that. So what are the different takes on that? Either was he hallucinating? Was he lying? Or what was this real?
Well, this actually ended up being like a hodgepodge of different stories that had come out and circulated over the years. A lot of it originating from a booklet that came out sometime in the early 1960s. And this was what was referred to as a samizdat, which means it was a booklet that was, let's say, like Xeroxed over and over and over again, and then spread from person to person. And then, like, maybe that person would Xerox copies and then send them on to other people. And this was allegedly Admiral Byrd's secret or lost diary, which told a story of him and a pilot who were making an attempt to fly over the North Pole, the Arctic Pole. All right. And during this expedition, the diary goes, they actually were accosted by several disc-shaped craft that had swastikas on them. And these disc-shaped craft actually communicated over the radio and said, you know, follow us or we'll shoot you down. And then they were taking allegedly into the polar opening, the northern polar opening. There's that one up again. Remember, I said that these stories circulated as far as into the 20th century. Well, this was one of them. And once they landed, they were escorted by human-looking pilots who came out of these crafts to a nearby city and were met by representatives of this great underground civilization, who then basically told them the same kind of information that you heard coming from the 1950 contactees. Now, the contactees were people who claimed that they had been visited and were continuing to have visits from occupants from UFOs from, say, like Venus and Mars. George Damski is a perfect example of one of the early 50s UFO contactees. But Admiral Byrd was allegedly told that the inner Earth people were watching the surface with horror because of our use of atomic weapons. and that if we didn't clean up our act and stop using them, then the inner earth people were going to come to the surface and kick our asses, basically. And then they let him go to come back and to tell the story. All right. Great story. And, you know, it circulated a lot. And that's where the stories that you were hearing about the flying over the ice fields and then coming across fields of grass and meadows and mastodons, you know, roaming around. These were the things that Bird allegedly saw once they had crossed over that threshold from the surface world into the inner earth. All right. The problem is, and this is what I discovered when I was writing that book, you know, Admiral Byrd's Journey Beyond the Poles, was that at the time that he was allegedly flying over the North Pole, he was actually part of Operation High Jump, which was taking place in Antarctica, clear on the other side of the planet, all right? Which Operation High Jump has its own mysteries associated with it. But I think that the reason that this booklet came out when it did with this type of story, it was an attempt to kind of distract what was going on with Operation High Jump, with, again, these crazy stories, all right? Disinformation.
Mm.
All right? So, you know, Operation High Jump, which took place in 1947, early 1947, right after the end of World War II. And it's odd because at that point, the Navy was decommissioning ships right and left. They didn't have any use for them anymore. The war was over. Why do we need all these ships? Well, then all of a sudden it was decided, no, we're going to recommission a lot of these ships and send a bunch of soldiers, a bunch of ships, including a submarine, some aircraft, and Admiral Byrd as the commander-in-chief of this operation to Antarctica. And there were various reasons given, none of them really very satisfying. Some of them was to, you know, look for valuable minerals for possible mining. Another was an attempt to train personnel on how to deal with the possibility that the Soviet Union was going to attack North America by coming over the Arctic, the North Pole, which that doesn't make sense because it would have been just a heck of a lot cheaper just to send people up to the Yukon or Alaska even to train them. You know, why commission all of these ships and you know, a couple of thousand soldiers and sailors to go all the way to Antarctica to do this? And we still really don't know. The one of the main theories was that they were looking for that Nazi base that we were talking about earlier, that this was an attempt because the British, there was information that was provided by the British in 1946, where this base was, and that possibly this was something of interest. And as well, there had been Nazi U-boats that had given themselves up at the end of the war to South America. And the captains basically, when they were being debriefed, you know, told their interrogators that, yeah, we just came from this base in Antarctica. We started out in South Africa and carried a bunch of, you know, equipment, personnel, other valuable things to this base. And then we were told to give ourselves up. Some of them said, we were then told to blow ourselves up after we did all this, but they said, you know, we're not going to do that. We're going to give ourselves up to a friendly nation, which, you know, would have been Argentina at the time. So, I mean, that's kind of a convoluted answer to your question, but it's a convoluted story. It's just there's so much that was involved that I came across, you know, while doing research for this book, that it's a fascinating story. And again, we still don't know just exactly what Admiral Byrd and his people were looking for. You know, the other strange thing is that Operation High Jump was supposed to last the entire Antarctic summer. But after about 6 weeks, they suddenly pulled out and came back. And there were a number of reporters, especially South American reporters, that were part of this expedition. And Admiral Byrd told them that they had to leave because he had something, he had a number of important things that he had to tell the United States Congress, and that it was his fear that the United States and the Western world was going to be attacked by, as he put it, missiles flying over Antarctica to attack us. And what's, to me, one of the odd things was that just a few months after Operation High Jump ended and they came back is when you saw the beginning of the whole modern UFO era. So, you know, he may have been onto something.
Well, yeah, it's interesting because I think you said in the book, or maybe I read the cell story, but there's a lot of Antarctica that has never, supposedly never been explored. So to me, it would make sense to still explore that and try to learn, maybe discover new species or whatever. So either, I don't know why we had abandoned that, or we are exploring there and it's secret, or we already know something and it's secret. So, I mean, there's a lot of could be a lot of secrets going on, right?
Oh yeah. Well, and you have to understand Antarctica is huge. I mean, yeah. I don't think people realize just how big.
It's a continent. Yeah,
it is. It's a continent, and it's so inhospitable. You know, I mean, it's one of the most inhospitable places on the planet. So we've only managed to explore just this small areas, you know, around the coast mostly. You know, the interior of it. There's been expeditions that, that have flown over it. I mean, that does happen. But as for actual having, feet on the ground through the rest of it, you know, it's virtually impossible to do so. We have some really nice satellite images of some very unusual looking things, what appears to be giant caves, mountains
you could discover things that, because of the temperatures and the frozen, I mean, there could be things frozen either on the surface or deep down below that would be really fascinating to see, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, the interior of the continent has been frozen for who knows how long. I mean, I'm not even going to try to hazard a guess, because there'll be somebody out there like, no, that's not right. It's been, probably more than a million years, I would say, because it's that continent has been at that location for quite a while.
But more than a million. So I'm terrible with math, and I'm probably going to look, maybe this is a dumb question. Is it possible there's like a dinosaur frozen, like deep down in some bottom cave somewhere, just totally frozen? Like, that would be cool.
That would be, I don't think that,
because they found, Neanderthal man that it was like froze, like it wasn't a skeleton. It was an actual, like it still had like remnants of the skin and hair and stuff, right?
No, I'm pretty sure. And I'm very fascinated by, archaeology and, ancient man. I don't think that there has ever been you may be thinking of, the guy that they found frozen in the Alps. Ozzy, I think is what they've called him. And I mean, he's pretty old. I mean, he was frozen like maybe about 5,000 years ago.
Okay. Maybe, yeah, that's what I'm thinking of.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, you know, I mean, he did. I mean, he was in a situation where somebody had shot him with an arrow while he was crossing this path, you know, from one temperate area to another. And he was up in the mountains, and obviously somebody was following him and shot him. And, you know, he just fell down and then was covered with ice and snow.
Yeah.
But that's been the oldest that anybody currently has found. Now,
I'm saying Antarctica, though, I mean, it could be a woolly mammoth. It could be some species that we don't know, we've never heard of, because
right,
we've never explored there.
Yeah, well, I mean, we do know that in the back in prehistoric times, that there were places in Antarctica that did have dinosaurs and plant life and things like that. You know, the climate, the Earth's temperature was a little bit hotter then. So there were species that, animal species that lived there. So, I mean, you know, if you had somebody, you know, somebody, if you had an animal that got off the beaten track, so to speak, and got down into a frozen valley and then was covered, died and was covered up, then yeah, that could be possible. If, you know, with global warming going on right now, there is the chance that we're going to start seeing a lot more things like that being uncovered, all across the planet, you know, Antarctic being one of them.
It's kind of like, I don't know if you're familiar, like I'm in Arizona and up in, is it Lake Mead? I think the one that it borders Arizona and Nevada, and it started to drain, and they started to find all this stuff. They were finding oil drums with dead bodies from the mob had dumped, and now the lake was drying up and they found these bodies. It was crazy. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, creepy.
There's definitely something going on in Antarctica, though. I just feel like people need, and maybe not. Maybe it's just ice and snow, and that's all there is. But it's still fascinating to me. I would love to explore it one day. If I was rich enough, I'd have an expedition and, you know, search every square mile. But
oh yeah, yeah. Well, and you know, some of these early. And when I mean early, I mean, you know, like a late 19th and early 20th century stories that circulated. It talked about how Antarctica was the home of an ancient civilization, and that but once the planet cooled down and everything was covered in ice and snow, it wasn't able to sustain itself, and that all of these ancient legends that we have of that we would call, say, like Atlantis and stories like that came from this civilization that used to live, you know, in what is now Antarctica. And, you know, like you said, until the time comes that we're able to either, you know, melt the snow and ice, or, you know, have the ability to look through it, we'll never know. But it's like I said before, considering how old the planet is and how early in the planet's development that life arose, it wouldn't surprise me in the least to find out that there have been other technology-based civilizations that have existed in the past that have come and gone and have been completely forgotten about, with the exception of these mythologies and probably the passing down of knowledge like mathematics, agriculture, things like that to help the next group of survivors survive.
Yeah. Well, and so, I mean, getting to your next book, the Tesla book is really fascinating too. And what I'm learning, that there's a lot of things I did not know. I think a lot of people know that he kind of helped develop the electrical grid that we have now, but I didn't know he was like a receiver. And there's like theories that maybe this knowledge of math and stuff is passed down to him. Like he would just get these ideas. And so where are the ideas? I mean, I guess it's similar. I interview a lot of musicians and they say like, I'm like, how do you come up with that song? It's just like, it just comes to me. So, but he was kind of receiver all this technology. Like he would visualize it and then make it work somehow.
Tesla was very much like that. And you know, you read these stories about people who seem to be born with genius. And that's not quite the right word, but they are born with that ability where this stuff just comes out of them. You were talking about musicians. You know, I was reading about Prince and his musical ability, and he was constantly, you know, having to write stuff down because it was just constantly flowing out of his head. And he said if he didn't write it down, he'd lose it. But that he was, you know, just 24 hours a day, apparently, the music was just coming out of him. And it's, you know, that's a fascinating ability that you see not only with musicians, but people who are gifted with mathematics, physics, and certain inventors as well. And Tesla was like that. I mean, you know, not only was he a whiz at mathematics, but he also had that ability to think of something. You know, he would get an idea and it'd be like, I wonder if that would work. And if it could work, then it would just explode out of his mind. And he had the ability where he said that once the idea came to him, he could see it like, and he didn't describe it as a hologram. He called them visions, but the description sounds like a hologram almost, where this vision would appear in front of his eyes of whatever it was that he was working on. If it was feasible, if it wasn't feasible, he would never have these visions. So he knew that he wasn't on the right track. But say like the AC motor, you know, Tesla was the guy who came up with the AC motor. And he was walking in a park with a friend, you know, talking about something completely different. And then all of a sudden, this vision just appeared, just popped in front of his eyes of an AC motor. And he said that he could turn it in any direction with his mind. He could tear it apart, put it back together again. He could see every little component in this vision. And he said he immediately had to go and like with a stick, draw it out in the dust because he was afraid he'd forget about it. But that was something that persisted with him all of his life, you know, for all of his greatest inventions, that, you know, he would have these visions on how these things could be produced. So, you know, the question is with people like Tesla and, you know, and others, including musicians, is this a component of the human mind that is just constantly churning this stuff out? And those of us, myself not included, who have this ability to bring it out, or are they tapping into some kind of universal resource? You know, the ancients called it, you know, the Akashic records, which supposedly was this cosmic knowledge base that permeates the universe. That it was part of creation. Creation couldn't have begun without information. And this information is all pervasive throughout this universe and all the multi-universes, and is also contained within us, all of us, because we're all part of creation. But that some people have that rare ability to tap into that. So I think that people like Tesla, and I've just been recently reading a couple of excellent books about a gentleman by the name of T. Townsend Brown, and then another guy named Farnsworth, who I don't know if that name is familiar with you, but he was the guy who invented the electronic television. You know, our whole television system came about by this guy who was born a genius. I mean, he grew up poor in Utah. And he got the idea for the electronic scanning lines that were used in televisions after he had plowed a potato field as a kid and saw these perfectly aligned furrows. And he was like, that's how an electronic television will work. And this was like in the early 1900s, you know, long before television was even a thing, you know. But at that young age, he was already thinking about things like that. And then the rest of his life showed that same kind of genius, including in his later years. In the early 1960s, he built a nuclear fusion device in Fort Wayne, Indiana, that he said, and some of the people around him who helped him build it, didn't require like the huge electromagnetic fields that they're trying to use now with the fission devices, trying to create, you know, like a miniature sun. He said that this was a device that you could, I mean, it was a desktop size device, and used its own power to contain itself.
Hmm.
So, I mean, you know, Tesla, Farnsworth, Townsend, these are perfect people for what I was talking about with this innate germ of genius that they were born with.
Yeah, and it's some of his Tesla's inventions came to fruition and then some didn't, but then also maybe we don't know, because it seems like from what I read in the book and the other research I've done is that some of his ideas have kind of been hijacked by other people, and you know, so the government may have taken some of his files and we don't have everything that he was working on. Maybe they stole some of his ideas.
Yeah. Tesla starting in the, in 1899, he built a laboratory in Colorado Springs, Colorado, first to test an idea that maybe he could harness lightning to power things, you know, like, you know, if you could harness lightning, you'd have almost, you know, like an infinite power source. But he found out that, you know, due to the, you know, static nature of lightning, that it's, you know, virtually impossible, at least at that time, to try to harness it. But when he was working on this, he discovered what would later become, you know, it became his all-consuming dream, and that was the wireless transmission of electricity. He had, after Tesla had built the electrical generating power plants at Niagara Falls, right? They were then going to use that to power the it was the World's Fair that was then taking place in New York at the time, but the commission to build the power lines were given to the Edison Company and not Tesla's company, and Tesla and Edison. That was a rivalry that went on through all of their adult life. And that always kind of stuck in Tesla's craw, that Edison was given the commission to provide the cables to send this power. So Tesla discovered that there was a way, several ways, that you could generate electricity in one location and then send it to another without cables. And he proved this theory in Colorado Springs. And then when he moved back to New York, he actually went and petitioned a lot of benefactors, including J.P. Morgan, to give him seed money to build a device on Long Island to, he was going to prove that this was going to work. However, he wasn't exactly upfront about telling these benefactors just exactly what this power plant was being built for. He told them, and this was true, he told them that this was going to be a tower used to broadcast radio and telephone, kind of like an early attempt at cell phone receptions, wireless telephone, and then eventually television. And left out the part that he was also going to generate electricity and send it through the air to people, because he realized that these people who had made their money off of Tesla's original concept of the AC motor, that how are you going to go and charge people mm-hmm. with electricity that's right. coming to you from the atmosphere? And that's exactly what happened. After he was more than halfway done building this tower when it got out that that's what he was trying to do. And not only did everybody pull their funds from him, but then they started circulating in the press that he was cheating them, that he was crazy, and his reputation just went to hell in a handbag, so to speak.
Yeah.
And it was a horrible thing. Because you know, before this, Tesla had made all these people rich, all right, and they owed him a lot. And in fact, when his company was on the verge of bankruptcy at some point, Tesla had told them, because they were paying him a lot of money in royalties for like every kilowatt of electricity that was being generated, and they mismanaged themselves, you know, almost to the brink of destruction. Tesla told them, look, you were nice enough to give me the original, you know, money to begin with, to build the Tesla motor, and then to, you know, prove it all by building the power plant in Niagara Falls. I'm going to waive all of that. Just be there to help me out when I want to do further research. And everyone was like, oh, God, yes. That didn't happen. Once the whole thing about the Tesla Tower came out, everybody just abandoned him and stabbed him in his back. Hmm. So it was just a horrible situation. And he never supposedly recovered from that. His name was Mudd. But he was still being carefully watched by various corporations, government agencies, even foreign government agencies, because of not only the things that he knew, but because of the things that he was later on experimented with and wrote about. One of the things being what he called the death beam, which essentially was
crazy.
Yeah, Tesla was the guy who came up with the particle beam weapon in the probably as early as well. I mean, you know, the early concepts probably came about at around the same time that he was working on his the powerless wireless transmission of electricity. Because the particle beam weapon would use like a charged beam of electricity, and then a substance like he conceived tungsten that was powdered to an almost microscopic level that would then be entered into this field and would act like billions of electrified bullets, just basically taking down aircraft and missiles, things like that. You know, the early 20th century is when he came up with that. So, and he actually offered it to the United States government in just before the beginning of World War II. But apparently he was ignored. The Soviet Union took him up on it. The Soviet Union actually paid him a substantial amount of money through a company, a United States company, who brokered deals with companies in the United States and the Soviet Union, because, you know, at that time you really weren't legally allowed to deal with the communist. And apparently the Soviet government was so happy with the results that a couple of years later, they actually gave him more money as a thanks, to it. Yeah, you don't hear about that a lot, but yeah. And so the FBI especially kept close watch on Tesla up until the final days of his life, when he was living in the New Yorker Hotel in Manhattan. There was actually several FBI agents who were living in that building as well, whose sole purpose was just to keep an eye on Tesla, possibly just to, you know what he was doing, but maybe also to protect him, because there were rumors that the Nazis were attempting to either kidnap him and take him over to Germany, or steal whatever material that they could get their hands on.
Yeah. Well, and didn't they build the Bell ship, or try to build that? And that was kind of, wasn't that based on his anti-gravity idea, that you'd get this high electrical power that would lift the machine off the ground and kind of have it float?
Supposedly. You know, nobody really knows this exactly what the Nazi Bell was going to be used for. But, you know, the information that has come down to us from that time, from various sources, looks suspiciously like some of the experiments that Tesla had been doing involving high-powered electromagnetic fields, and then some kind of circulating, fast-circulating material, either mercury or maybe bismuth, then either energize this field or be a source to carry this field, almost like in a geometrical torquing situation. The theory at the time being is that if you could use high-powered electromagnetics, you could actually create what was called a torque that would warp space-time. And if you could warp space-time, then you could do all kinds of things, like, you know, like achieve anti-gravity, you know, I kind of chafe at that word, you know, field propulsion or the negating of gravity. But not only that, it would also have an influence on space-time. And you would see a warping in localized time and localized space as well. So, you know, it could be very well that the Nazis were using this to achieve, you know, who knows what. They may not have even have known, you know, what they were doing. They may have gotten, you know, these ideas, and these various scientists would say, well, let's just put this all together and see what happens. You know, that's kind of my suspicion myself, is that, you know, they had some vague ideas that maybe they could develop some kind of weapon using this process, but not knowing what the results would be, let's just build it and see what happens. And, you know, apparently this device produced a radiation field, and I'm using radiation because they don't really know what kind of radiation it was, that extended out at least as far as 600 feet, and that anything that came in contact with this field died. You know, plant life, a number of scientists, unfortunately, the slave laborers that were being used at this facility in Poland to build all this. But, you know, it's to me, it's a mystery on what exactly they were trying to achieve. But I'm pretty certain that they were using Tesla-based technology, you know, on this device.
What do you think? I don't know if you're familiar with, like, the Bob Lazar, the ex Area 51 employee, and the machine that he described, it sounded kind of similar. Do you think that's similar to what Tesla was describing with kind of anti-gravity?
Let's see. Is this was this a machine that was inside like the scout ship that was using, what was it, Element 115?
Something like that. Yeah. I'm not super familiar with the details. I just remember, from what I remember when I was reading about the Tesla thing, I was like, oh, this sounds like the thing Bob Lazar was describing on that the episode of Rogan that I saw.
Yeah, it probably somewhat, at least maybe the science would be similar, albeit, you know, probably 1,000 years more sophisticated than anything that that Tesla or the Nazis or even we would be working on, because I think one of the attributes of this that Lazar said was that even when this thing was turned off, that the space around it was warped, that inside the craft, when he was working on it, that first of all, the inside of the craft was like the Doctor Who TARDIS was a lot bigger on the inside than it was on the outside, and that time didn't flow the same way on the inside as it did on the outside. He said that he would go inside to do something and spend what, you know, like a half hour and come out and find that 8 hours had passed, you know, when he was inside. And that's, you know, that's supposedly some of the attributes to this torsion effect that in theory could be achieved using these high-powered, especially rotating, counter-rotating electromagnetic fields.
Yeah. So does that kind of connect to the Philadelphia experiment? Because I find that fascinating as well. You touched about that, I think, in two of the books. Mm-hmm. But suppose, I mean, this is all coming out kind of like in bits and pieces. Like, we don't have an official report on this. So I don't know how, like, this is kind of like almost rumor gossip in a way, the story of the Philadelphia experiment.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, the Philadelphia experiment, the story first came out in the 1950s after this guy named an astronomer, actually, by the name of Morris Jessup, wrote a book called The Case for the UFO. And at some point, he started getting letters from a guy who called himself Carlos Allende, who claimed that some of the things that Jessup had written about in his book were true, and that Allende had actually been witness to the Philadelphia experiment. And this is the first time that that story had ever came out anywhere. And that he said that that there had been a ship that had been wrapped in cables in an attempt, and he said at the time, in an attempt to achieve invisibility, and that when power was run through it, the ship actually not only became invisible, but disappeared and then reappeared in in Norfolk, Virginia, and then vanished again and then reappeared back in the Philadelphia shipyard. Well, after it did this, the sailors who were on board were in horrible conditions. Some of them had disappeared completely. Some of them were found halfway embedded in the bulkhead of the ship, still alive. And others didn't appear to have any kind of problems at all, but then would suddenly just burst into flames and would be reduced to ashes. And this would happen, like, you know, days after the initial experiment.
Wasn't there a story too of there was a soldier? I mean, again, this is all allegedly, but there was a soldier that was in his kitchen and he disappeared and then he reappeared screaming and then disappeared again forever. And that is horrifying. It sounds far-fetched, but
this was a story that because apparently after this information started to come out, and I should add that the Navy has vehemently for years denied that this ever happened, that it was just, you know, It's just made up, you know, wasn't anything like it ever took place, and that it, you know, it's all just a story. But there was, I guess, a family of a soldier, or not a soldier, he was a sailor, that had been reported missing in action, which, you know, during the war, that was all too common. And that one day when they were having dinner, all of a sudden he walked through the wall and looked around at everyone. And of course, everyone's like, oh, you know, and then just fell to his knees screaming and then vanished, never to be seen again. So, you know, the speculation is that he may have been one of the sailors who had been volunteered to be part of the Philadelphia experiment. I guess that apparently some of the sailors who did survive were shipped off to various insane asylums. They weren't even given the chance to, say, be recommissioned to some other, some other place. No, they were just shipped off, never to be able to talk about it again. And if they did, who's going to believe them? So this story circulated for quite a while, and other investigators have dug up possible evidence on how this could have been a reality. The name of the ship supposedly that is now kicked around as being the ship was the SS Eldridge. I'm still not totally convinced that this was the ship that was involved. Because there are some discrepancies on when the ship had been commissioned and when it was actually in Philadelphia and things like that. Though there's an interesting story that after the end of the war, the ship was sold to the Greek Navy. And one of the engineers who was on this ship when it was owned by the Greek Navy, said that there were a lot of very suspicious and extremely large cables that were embedded in the bulkhead of this ship that he could never find any explanation on why they were there. And that kind of fits in with the tradition of the ship used in this experiment, that it was wrapped in cables, some of them built into the bulkhead of the ship, and then others then, crisscrossing back and forth, connected to huge Tesla coils to generate the power. Supposedly, the original experiments were to see if they could achieve electromagnetic invisibility, not visual invisibility at first, but just electromagnetic invisibility to try to prevent the ship from attracting ocean mines that would they'd be attracted by the metal hull. The mines were magnetic. If you got too close, they would then attach themselves to the ship and blow up. This was common use, by the Nazis and the Japanese at the time. But once the experiment started, they found that the magnetic field, the electromagnetic field that was produced, always seemed to also have the ability to deflect light. Optical invisibility, that would be a very cool thing too, to have. The Navy was doing all kinds of research on various kinds of optical invisibility with their ships. They would go and put like huge spotlights all up and down on either side of the ship. And in the daytime, with these lights turned on, the ship would basically just blend right into the sky. You couldn't see it at all because the lights would be almost as bright as the sun. Some of them had like black and white zebra type patterns painted on them, to see if that would work as well. So if this ship could attain not only electromagnetic but optical invisibility, hey, this was really this was a plus. Unfortunately, it seems like that it also had very negative effects on the crew involved, whether or not the stories about people actually being embedded in the bulkhead are true or not. We've seen similar types of experiments. There was a guy in Canada by the name of John Hutchison who was doing very similar experiments in his apartment. We were talking about eccentric geniuses earlier. This was the guy who, would buy all kinds of surplus equipment and building his own Tesla coils and stuff. And he was achieving some just absolutely fascinating results with things levitating, pieces of wood becoming embedded in metal, things like that, very similar to the results that you've seen supposedly with the Philadelphia experiment.
Well, and what about the Montauk project? Because that one is really fascinating to me. I can't find a lot of stuff about it. Other than it was an elite black project investigating paranormal, psychic, and unconventional sciences. Supposedly, this is what Stranger Things is kind of loosely based on, these, because they were using kids and stuff. Supposedly, this is all alleged or whatever. I don't know that we have. Does the government even admit it that that's a thing, or what? They won't tell us what they were doing on that base, but there is a base there on Long Island.
Right. It's the former Camp Hero on Long Island is where it was located at. The Montauk experiments were allegedly an offshoot of what was discovered with the Philadelphia experiment, and taking the process that not only did the ship obtain optical invisibility, but that these magnetic fields and then back again to this torsion effect actually created a warp in space-time, a highly localized warp that caused this ship to briefly vanish from our reality, appear someplace else, and then snap back into place again, which is one of the reasons why the organic matter, sailors, suffered so badly, from this. So the Montauk Project was a continuation with this, trying to see if not only could the results be replicated, but how then you could... not save the people, but protect people involved, which then kind of became embroiled in what the CIA was doing in the 50s, 60s, and 70s called MKUltra, which was their attempts at mind control, to try to see what could be used to either gain information from people using mind control, or if you could, the Manchurian Candidate, if you could control a person's mind to make them assassinate somebody, without them even knowing that they had become an assassination. And through this whole process, supposedly it was discovered that using the same kind of advanced electronics, that you could enhance the psychic abilities in certain people. Not everybody. There are some people, again, kind of going back to these people, like the eccentric geniuses, there are some people who are born with natural psychic abilities that under the right conditions, using the right kind of technologies, and that's what they were trying to work on, you could enhance this these abilities to accomplish all kinds of different things. I don't know if you're familiar with the anime Akira, but it's kind of the same principle. They were using drugs to enhance people's psychic abilities in this anime, but like Stranger Things, they they got their entire idea from the Montauk projects, that you could use, you know, children especially, because they're young, and you can through really horrendous methods create sub personalities in them. Think of split personalities. That's the old term.
Dissociative identity disorder.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, yeah, exactly. But if you apparently if you traumatize children enough, then they will develop these split personalities that have no knowledge of each other, and then these split personalities can be used to do, you know, whatever you want them to do. And that also includes if they have advanced psychic abilities, then you could get them to use these psychic abilities to do whatever it is that you want to. And that's, you know, that's kind of in a nutshell, you know, what the Montauk Project is about. But allegedly, they went and kidnapped first children from, say, like Mexico or South America, you know, like poor homeless children, and then later recruited. Older teenagers from the United States, again, kind of the same situation, like maybe homeless and, you know, on the street, with the promise of, you know, a job, better life, things like that, and then perform these horrible experiments, you know, on them.
And there's testimony, is there testimony of people in the town that can corroborate some of this stuff?
Yeah, well, you know,
they saw some weird things, right?
Yeah. Well, see, supposedly at this time, you know, Camp Hero had been decommissioned and was no longer operating. Yet people in the town were well aware that there was still something going on there, because there was still a lot of activity, you know, a lot of military vehicles going in and out, lights coming from the base. There were times that when there was like massive interference taking place, you know, like on their televisions and radios, other types of electronic equipment in the town. There was one instance where their dogs mostly just freaked out. Like every dog in this nearby community freaked out and ran outside and was barking and, you know, frothing at the mouth and doing weird stuff. And then all of a sudden just stopped and came inside, you know. You know, at the time, you know, I don't know if people... Some, of course, were naturally thinking that, well, they're doing something on the base. Others didn't know. But once these stories started circulating about the Montauk Project, you know, some of the townspeople were like, I wonder if there is a connection to that.
Right.
You know, but, you know.
We don't know for sure, but it sure is interesting.
Exactly. Well, and also there would like there'd be like mysterious power failures and brownouts in the town with no explanation on what was going on. But you know, I mean, a number of explorers would get themselves onto the base. It's now become a like a state park.
Right.
So, yeah,
but inside is sealed off or whatever.
Parts of it are. But at that time, even though it was decommissioned, it was sealed off and there were still guards patrolling the area. But some people would get, you know, would sneak on and look for some of these locations that were said to have been part of the original Montauk Project, and were finding, you know, some of these buildings, some of these secret tunnels that, you know, weren't supposed to be on the base, but were there. There was a guy named Al Bielek who allegedly, and, you know, he's got a whole story about his alleged participation with the Philadelphia experiment. But supposedly he was also part of then the subsequent Montauk Project. And whether or not you believe his story or not, because a lot of it is very, very wild and you know, I think kind of far-fetched, he was very knowledgeable about some of these secret locations on the base. There's at least one video that I've seen where he took some of these explorers onto the base and was showing them the locations of these secret tunnels from these buildings. I mean, and these buildings, you know, at this point, like falling apart and trashed. But I mean, he would go and say, okay, right here is a door. And then they'd force it open. And sure enough, it would lead down into these tunnels. And he would say, like, well, this was where, you know, this stuff took. And I mean, it's obviously these tunnels went on and on and on. He also talked about there was one building that was used with for LSD experiments, you know, because that was part of the supposed training with these kids. They'd dose them up, you know, with high amounts of LSD and, you know, either hook them up to these various machines that were supposed to enhance their psychic abilities or whatever. But, you know, some of these buildings were then used as coming down buildings. One of these buildings, he said, was a coming down building, and the walls were painted. Some of the rooms were painted in like psychedelic colors. Others had flowers and, you know, like, you know, pretty landscapes, you know, on them. And so he took them to this one building that was, you know, really at the point that it was getting ready to fall over. And once they got inside, sure enough, these rooms had just exactly as he described it. So, you know, obviously there was some kind of weird stuff going on at Camp Hero. And again, whether or not the stories that have circulated and have come down to us are true, or if they're, you know, like a mishmash of truth and disinformation, you know, which, I mean, I think that's probably a high probability. What we have to try to weed out is, you know, what's the truth? You know, what's the made up stuff? You know, because the truth may be even more crazy than what we're being told now.
Right. That's what I found. A lot of times truth is stranger than fiction even.
Yeah, exactly.
What about, because one thing that we do know is a real thing right now that's happening is, I don't know a lot about it, but maybe you can explain how maybe this fits in with some of the stuff we've talked about, time, space, Tesla's experiments, CERN. What is going on at CERN? I mean, I just see the machines and I'm like, I mean, I don't know what they're trying to do, but they might accidentally do something, or maybe they're trying to do something really crazy, right?
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, you know, CERN's a particle accelerator, which, I mean, they use that in the most basic terms, is that they would take one particle and slam it into another and see what breaks off. And when I mean particle, I mean, you know, like electrons and, I mean, just the building blocks of reality. And the theory being that, you know, if you can break up these particles into their component pieces and then break up these component pieces into even more smaller pieces, you know, you'll discover just exactly how the universe works. All right. So, I mean, naturally, when you're doing, and I should point out that the United States was going to have their own particle accelerator in Texas back in the 1980s. And it was like halfway built, but then Congress pulled the money from it. And now it just sits derelict. So it's just, you know, really, really a shame that it was not allowed to complete, you know, what they intended to do. But, you know, there's been all kinds of stories that that CERN has been able to open holes in time-space, There's the fear that they're going to create a black hole, and then, you know, once a black hole is created, that they won't be able to stop it, and eventually the entire planet will get sucked into it. One of the stories that I've run across, and there's this a really good video, but I mean it's obviously CGI in my opinion, of a what appears to be a wormhole appearing above the community. With you know, like a swirling light in the clouds, and it looks fantastic, and that and then like UFOs come flying out of it and stuff, but I think probably the majority of the wilder stories that you're hearing about CERN are just I doubt if it has that capability, considering that that's what it does. It's simply a particle accelerator. Now, I suppose that there is the possibility that if you break down a certain element to a point that it could create some kind of unknown particle that we've never dealt with before, that maybe hasn't even been thought about in theoretical physics, that it could have some kind of devastating effect. It's not likely. But then again, you know, weirder things have happened in science. You know, stranger discoveries have come about, you know, from just such experiments looking for something else, and discovering something that is, you know, was thought entirely impossible. You know, remember, in my opinion, I don't think that anything is really impossible. We just don't have the technology yet developed for it. And that's how science progresses,
right?
You know, with impossible discoveries.
Well, yeah. And so, some of this stuff is accidental, like in your time travel book. I mean, people can read it and just you know, decide for themselves whether these are real or not, but they're stories of basically these time slips where people step into like what appears to be a different time and space. So, I mean, who knows, like, you know, what you're messing with and how the stuff works, and we don't understand it, but it is fascinating. And I take it all with a grain of salt, but I found the books really interesting. I highly recommend all those three. And I know you have many more as well. So is there anything else currently? I know this mimics your latest book.
Yeah, mimics the Others Among Us, and that book is an examination of the history of human encounters with beings that look human but probably aren't, and we take this all the way back through history. Mm. You know, from ancient Mesopotamia, biblical times, you know, right up to modern times. You know, in the past, people would call them, you know, angels or demons, to, you know, fairies, leprechauns. And, you know, nowadays we don't believe in those sort of things, but we do think that it's possible that there's life on other planets. So now we have encounters with alleged extraterrestrials.
Right. And well, there's some people that think that what we're seeing, the aliens, that those are angels or demons, or it's maybe connected somehow.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's and that's one of the things that we look at, you know, in this book, is the cultural aspect of the identity, yeah, of these things, which seem to have the ability to take on your cultural expectations. You know, right, like I said, right now we think that, you know, it could be possible that we're being visited by extraterrestrials. You know, 500 years from now, I think the phenomena will still persist, but there'll be something else, you know, whatever the, you know, the cultural expectations of that day will be, you'll have the same kind of unknown phenomena.
Right. Well, thank you so much for doing this. I'll have to check out that book. I'll have to have you back on if you want to come back on at some point. This has been a lot of fun.
Oh, my pleasure, Chuck. I enjoyed talking with you. You asked some really good questions here, and I hope I was able to keep up with you.
Yeah, no, I hope I was able to keep up with you. It was a fascinating topic, really great stuff. So thank you so much. And people can find the books on your website, on Amazon. You're on Instagram as well.
Yes, that's correct. All of the above. Some of my books you can find at your favorite local bookstores or your library. And please patronize both, because reading is a fundamental aspect of our society, and banning books is un-American.
Absolutely. I agree. Yeah. And I like the physical copies of these because they got the pictures. I usually do Audible, but these books are pretty short and they got the pictures, and they're nice and big. For an old guy like me, I can read it. I can see the words. So they're great. They're great books. I highly recommend them.
Thank you. I appreciate you saying that.
All right. Thank you so much. We'll see you next time.
All right. Thanks, Chuck.
Okay. Bye-bye.